Although Mexicans are justly proud of their struggle for liberty against foreign oppression, they have found political liberty at home harder to obtain. And since achieving independence in 1821, Mexico has been ruled mostly by dictatorships. So why this deficit in political liberty? It's interesting that Tocqueville notices this problem in Democracy in America. He commented that the Mexicans, having adopted a federal and republican constitution, much like that of the United States, yet continued shifting between anarchy and despotism. Now, of course, Tocqueville saw the political problem as something more fundamental than institutions and procedures. In fact, he referred to Mexicans having adopted the letter of the law, but not the spirit of the law, which gave it life. Whereas in the United States, the political temper of the people could sustain a system balancing the requirements of liberty and democracy. In Mexico, following the pathology outlined by Plato, democracy seemed invariably to collapse into tyranny. And we could cite some many reasons for this breakdown, but I'll just indulge myself by naming a few. I think it's appropriate to quote from Dr. von Kuhnelt-Leydin at this moment in his book, Liberty or Equality, in which he spoke of the thanatocentrism of Ibero-American cultures, that is, their preoccupation with death. And this tends to engender, he says, both an intense love of liberty, yet one that is untempered by a spirit of compromise. That this is the key, in a sense, to their latent revolutionism, as well as this peculiar craving for freedom. Now, I couldn't help but be struck by this awkward but pregnant with meaning word, thanatocentrism, when I was thinking of Mexico in the Day of the Dead celebration, or that part of Octavio Paz's Labyrinth of Solitude, in which he describes this once reminder of death and yet a mockery of it. And think of how this adds to their sense of liberty and yet this inability to come to terms with those who oppose them. And likewise, there's something else I think needs to be added about the political culture of Mexico. And it has to do with those who intensely oppose the Catholic cultural project there that would organize then in the 19th century, early 19th century, into Masonic lodges that were essentially conduits for radical Enlightenment ideas. Now, these lodges have had a lasting effect on the development of the Mexican political system, and they've given to it its peculiar liberal authoritarian characteristics. But what Mexico has lacked is an authentic classical liberalism in which the government in power has the confidence and security to tolerate a loyal opposition that is critical of it, competitive with it, and yet supportive of the constitutional order. And unlike the England's Whig-Tory reconciliation after the Glorious Revolution, Mexico has never enjoyed a similar event which would create an atmosphere of tolerance in order to enable political liberty to flourish. Now, because of this, I think, inherent inability to compromise, at least during the 19th century, Mexican political life was deeply divided by great issues: monarchy versus republicanism, centralism versus federalism, protectionism versus free trade, church versus state. Since neither the conservatives nor the liberals cared to budge on these issues, a sporadic civil war resulted, ending finally in 1867, in which the liberals under Benito Juarez won. Now, the Mexican historian Enrique Krause, in his great book, Mexico, The Biography of Power, has indicated that he considers this time after 1867 a flourishing of political liberty under Juarez. But I'd say that 1867 was no 1688. Although the conservative Catholics were militarily defeated and politically ostracized, the Catholic faith still dominated the culture of the nation. And although the other great issues would eventually be greatly diminished, this church versus state issue has still remained an angry wound. And 50 years later, after Juarez's victory, the Mexican Revolution would reaffirm that no resurgence of the Catholic Party would occur, and the victorious revolutionaries, without the participation of any Catholic politicians, drafted a constitution that stripped the church of its legal rights and teaching responsibilities. So Mexico, to appropriate a phrase by the sociologist Peter Berger, truly became a nation of Hindus ruled by an elite of Swedes. It is therefore fruitless to discuss democracy in Mexico without first considering whether this great religious issue has been reconciled. I believe that crucial to the realization of political liberty is the acceptance of the long-excluded Catholic Party as worthy participants in the public square by those modern-day descendants of the 19th century liberals, the revolutionary family of the Institutional Revolutionary Party. I think a reconciliation is more attainable today than it is in the 19th century, because beginning in our century, in an ironic turn of history, Catholics took up the fight for political liberty against liberal authoritarianism. And the struggle for political liberty continues today among the distant relatives of those 19th century conservatives, that is the National Action Party, or PAN. Rerum Novarum in 1861 shook the earth under Catholics' feet. And before the Mexican Revolution in 1910, inspired by Leo XIII's social doctrine, Catholics began to organize to try to cope with the social problems in their country. But this natural social reform lended itself to try to have a political solution. They formed a political party. It participated in the government under Madero in 1911, but the revolution swept it away. And that was essentially the end of this effort by Huerta's coup in 1913. During the 20s, when the revolutionaries then were in power, Catholics made one or two choices. They completely retreated from the public square, or they launched an open rebellion, the Cristero Revolt. By the 1930s, the revolutionary family had consolidated its power into a single party state. At the end of the decade, Catholics would once again try to launch a political party, and that is National Action. And this was founded by businessmen and Catholic intellectuals, essentially to oppose the popular front turn of the revolutionary family. Now, the revolutionary family, by reasons of expediency and good politics, decided that they should allow this to survive. After all, the revolution itself needed some reactionaries to compete against it in order to legitimize itself. While leaning heavily on the twin pillars of the party and the almighty presidency, the revolutionary family hadn't dared to dispense with the form of political liberty. It still maintained a bicameral legislature. It had periodic elections. It had a nominal independence of state government and municipal government. So the Panistas, no reactionaries, decided to fulfill the political revolution of Madero by beginning a competition into the public square. This would be a gradualist strategy. They had no illusions. There had to be a civic education. They had to build up grassroots support. They would compete for local office in the hope that this would eventually be recognized. Now, the party is distinguished in its founding by two wings. One is a business wing led by Manuel Gomez Morin, who was a revolutionary but in a classical liberal sense. His group was comprised at the time of mostly northern businessmen. The other group, Efrain Gonzalez Luna, who was a friend of Jacques Maritain, very much influenced by French Catholic revival and the Catholic social doctrine. This group derived mainly from what I call the Mexican Bible Belt. This is all the area of the Cristero Revolt, Michoacán, Jalisco, Guanajuato, in the center of the country. PAN, interestingly for a Catholic party, was an urban party, whereas Catholic parties in the past, especially in Latin America, had been mostly agrarian. It enjoyed a lot of support among the middle class in Mexico City and in large cities like Puebla, León, Guadalajara, and Morelia. Not surprisingly, it encountered difficulty in the more populous Indian regions of the south, which were most heavily incorporated by the Revolutionary Families Party. With the exception of Yucatan, which has always had an anti-Mexico City heritage. Now, PAN looked to accomplish four goals, four freedoms, if you will. to restore political democracy, to protect free enterprise and property rights, to defend the right to private religious education, and to restore to the church its legal personality. Although inspired by the Catholic social doctrine, the Christian concept of the human person, and the principles of subsidiarity and the common good, Pan also took pains to distance itself from the clergy. For prudential and, to a lesser extent, for ideological reasons, Pan also kept the Christian democratic movement, which it preceded, at arm's length. This, at least for its first 20 years. This would change in the 1960s and the 1970s, after Vatican II and the Conference of Catholic Bishops in Medellin. But during this time, from the 1940s up to about 1980, this was Pan's 40 years in the wilderness. And I think it's characterized by an exchange between presidential candidate Efrain González Morfín, son of one of the founders, and the presidential candidate of the PRI, who was Luis Echeverria Álvarez. They were to have a presidential debate, and Luis Echeverria said to him, "Why? We're the revolutionaries. We won already." This, I believe, summarizes the climate of respect for the opposition in Mexico at that time. So all Pan was able to do was win a few municipalities and then token seats in the Chamber of Deputies until the 1980s. At that time, the revolutionary family really began its painful divorce. The debt crisis of 1982 aggravated the differences between the PRI's own business wing and its socialist wing. The revolutionary family couldn't respond as a unified whole anymore. In response, so-called neo-panistas stepped forward. This group was less inclined to wage the struggle for eternity in Mexico and more interested in doing what it takes to win power. And I think a point to mention about them, although pro-business, many of them kept connections with Coparmex, which is a union of Mexican business people. This group also has a great deal of interest in inculcating the ideas of Catholic social doctrine into the business community. Now, their leader was Manuel Cloutier, who was an agribusinessman from the northern state of Sinaloa. He's the party's Lecuelense. He emphasized a more confrontational approach with the government, yet in the spirit of nonviolence, which the party always promoted. Now, Pan was out in the 80s, was emerging out of the shadows. And this was forcing PRI into ever more blatant acts of patriotic fraud. A phrase, I believe, used by Manuel Bartlett Diaz, then Secretary of Government, who told intellectuals at the time, "If you support Pan, you are letting into Mexico the influence of our three greatest enemies, the business community, the Catholic Church, and the United States." Perhaps he was right 2 out of 3. Pan has never been particularly pro-American due to cultural reasons. But you can see, however, this latent hostility going back to the liberals from the 19th century. Yet despite this upsurge during the 80s, the party only finished a distant third in 1988. It was overshadowed by an opposition coalition of disaffected priistas and ex-communists under the leadership of Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas. Yet, despite this disappointing outcome, the modernizer Carlos Salinas decided to negotiate with the PAN leadership and agreed to recognize their legitimate victories. Seeing an opportunity, PAN decided to support his objective to privatize the economy, to pass NAFTA, and to repeal the anti-clerical articles of the Constitution. Now, why did Salinas feel he had to do this? He ran considerable risks with his own party in doing so. Perhaps Pan did better in 1988 elections than is actually believed. The fraud was so widespread that no one can prove who won, and official records have been destroyed. Interestingly, Manuel Cloutier thought he had obtained 40% of the vote, but his advisors had felt the three parties would be split three ways. Now, I believe this Pan's modus vivendi with Salinas demonstrated that a vital common ground could be reached between the Catholic Party and the revolutionary family. Although some Panistas claimed this was a sellout to the PRI. I think that PAN finally recognized this as an opportunity to drive their foot into the door of the political system. They took advantage of it. They won the state of Baja California. Then they won Chihuahua. Then they forced an interim government to be appointed in Guanajuato under their leadership. By presidential election of 1994, they finished, although a distant second to PRI's Ernesto Zedillo, they still gained 27%, by far their largest tally ever. After the election, PAN's momentum continued. They won the state of Jalisco. They won re-election in Guanajuato. They won re-election in Baja California. They now govern 11 of the largest 14 cities in the country, over 250 municipalities, even in places like liberal Veracruz. By their own estimate, this is 38% of the population. It is developing from a pressure group into a mass party. During this period, from 1994 to the present, it looked as though PAN was gaining momentum while the other two parties were staying in place. This led, I think, the PANistas to be very overconfident for this election in July of 1997, where they felt that they could actually finally unhorse PRI as the dominant party in the Chamber of Deputies. But the disgrace of Carlos Salinas and a very energetic campaign to attach PAN with his neoliberal reforms took its toll. And so the elections last July were disappointing. In the Mexico City campaign, nothing but a series of disasters for the PAN. The wrong candidate was selected, and he ran the wrong campaign. He was also excluded from the nationally televised debate by the two candidates from the PRD and the PRI. So all the fault is not entirely his. Although the PRD, that is the other section of the revolutionary family under Cardenas, slightly edged the PAN in the Chamber of Deputies voting, PAN still sent to the chamber its largest delegation ever, 122 seats. In the Senate, the party failed slightly better, easily occupying the number two spot, although this matters less constitutionally. Yet the success of these two opposition parties now, so-called, in denying PRI a majority for the first time ever, I think will bring about a true separation of powers between the executive and legislature, something we haven't seen since 1911. But besides for these apparent PAN disappointments, there also were some surprising victories. PAN won convincingly in Nuevo León, which is home to the industrial center of Monterrey. And in a surprising victory, it upset the pre-presidential aspirant in Querétaro. This is an important, I think, symbolic victory. Querétaro is in some senses both the Petrograd and the Philadelphia of the revolutionary family. Here Juarez defeated Maximilian in 1867, and here was that the revolutionaries adopted their Magna Carta, the Constitution of 1917. In honor, PRI always holds its annual conventions in Querétaro, and they're probably looking for another venue as we speak. And finally, PAN did well in places they had never been competitive before, especially San Luis Potosí and Sonora. I believe it still represents the main opposition party in Mexico due to its executive experience. Yet by its own estimation, it must win at least 4 states of the next 17 gubernatorial elections if it is to be competitive in the year 2000. And clearly the old order is giving way in Mexico. The PRI can no longer resort to patriotic fraud as it once had, and is finding it very difficult to compete, even when enjoying a big advantage in money and resources. Salinas's liberalization helped demystify an aspect of the revolution that said the economy must be in the hands of the state. It also helped cripple the PRI's corporatist structure, which controlled labor and the peasants, and inadvertently is bringing about the demise of presidentialism with his feckless successor, Ernesto Zedillo. There's an anecdote on this involving PAN. When the bailout debate was going on in Mexico, a PAN delegate, Jorge Padilla, decided to oppose what the President Zedillo was proposing, that is, to use Mexican oil assets as collateral for the debt. He was brought into the presidential palace at Los Pinos and had a 2-hour debate with Ernesto Zedillo, at one point saying, "Fíjate, Ernesto," which is something you don't say to the president of Mexico. After it was over, he received a call from some of the PAN deputies, and they said, "Jorge, you should back down on this one. It's not worth the effort." But he stood to his ground, and this made Proceso the major newsweekly in Mexico. Weeks later, a PAN delegation went to Cuba. They had an interview with Fidel Castro. When they got off the plane, Fidel greeted them and said, "¿Cómo está Jorge Padilla?" They said, "Why, Fidel? Why do you ask about Jorge?" He says, "Because he directly defied the president of Mexico. If he lives, it's the end of presidentialism." While this order of PRI is disintegrating, it's going back, I believe, to its pre-1929 state, in which local leaders in the various rural communities, rural states, essentially ran their districts like Oriental potentates. We see this now in Puebla, where even though PAN has been winning many municipalities there, and including the capital of the state, they completely swept the PRI, that is, completely swept all the congressional delegation. Other states, Tabasco, Chiapas, Yucatan. This is the way the revolutionary family was before it organized into a party. It's destabilizing. Now finally, as the president of PAN recently remarked, PAN is a first world party in a third world country. It is yet to prove that it can be successful in the most backward and populous parts of Mexico. And unlike the Philippines or Poland, two inspiring examples for panistas during the 80s, Mexico's political class, I believe, doesn't suffer from the same crisis of confidence that those in Philippines and Poland did. Much of the revolutionary family is committed to remaining in power, with or without PRI as an electoral mechanism. Indeed, the PRD, the other wing of the revolutionary family, may become the preferred instrument in the coming months. Some have noted indications, indeed, of PAN's growing isolation in the political system. Defections are occurring between PRI and PRD, but not to PAN. The differences between those two parties have always been more of kin than of kind. The challenge for PAN will be to keep the revolutionary family divided. They can do this on the issues. One way might be to stress the humane economy, economic platform, which briefly came up in the 1994 election with their presidential candidate. Panistas have told me they're much more inspired by the social market economy model of Adenauer and Earhart than they are by, say, an American model. This might serve as an alternative between the neoliberalism of Salinas, which he called social liberalism, tellingly, and Cardenas' neo-socialism. And finally, I believe that PAN faces some serious internal challenges, and I'll list three. As it is evolving to become a mass party, its traditional ideology based on the Catholic social doctrine would tend to get diluted. Many of the traditionalists in the party have believed that they should maintain this intact. They shouldn't risk the army for the battle. In an example of this, this has been very a disincentive to newcomers. The mayor of Puebla, a panista who was recently elected, complained that he was considered somewhat of an outcast because before his recent arrival to the party, he didn't learn the words to the PAN fight song. But he managed to win Puebla anyway. Now, number two, the PAN needs a leader of national stature. Refreshingly, in the past, the party never had a caudillo in the tradition of other Latin American parties. I think it could use one now. After the suspicious automobile death of Manuel Cloutier in 1989, there's been no clear standard bearer. Vicente Fox, the governor of Guanajuato, is a panista, a very dynamic, charismatic figure, and he's somewhat of the Ross Perot of Mexico. He's a man of very heterodox views, He invited more people from the PRD to his inauguration than he did the PAN due to an internal dispute. But his pragmatic position, that is, forming alliance with the PRD, may be in the ascendant, because the leader of the traditionalists, Carlos Castillo Paraza, was the one so resoundingly defeated in Mexico City. PAN needs to get this maverick back into the corral, because if he's jilted by the party in this convention in the year 2000, he may run as an independent, and that would split the party, I think. And finally, in keeping with our tradition of here discussing the drug issue, as we notice from reading in the Mexican press, this isn't affecting every institution, even those always considered to be somewhat impervious to it, especially the army and the church. A couple of items recently have noted that this is not true. Now, PAN governs two states in which the narco trafficking flourishes, Baja California and Chihuahua, including the mayor of Tijuana and the mayor of Ciudad Juarez. For its greatest challenge, I think, will be to remain somewhat insulated from this corruption, which will be far worse for it than it would be for the other parties in the revolutionary family. With that, I'll end my remarks. Thank you.